Hi folks, just before we get into this morning's podcast, I just want to give a quick reaction to the opinion poll. Obviously we've been at this now the last few weeks saying that the trend is down for Fine Gael, and it's also showing that Fianna Fáil aren't really gaining ground. But this is really, we're really hopeful. There is the opportunity here, if people get out and vote. It's this day next week. So get out and vote. Make sure you talk to your friends and family. Get them out and vote. Vote for change. Vote progressive. Vote left. You know, this is the opportunity. It's not the next time we go to the polls. We don't have to wait around and you know, and then let's be honest here. Just because there's a change of government doesn't mean everything's going to be fixed overnight as well. We need to be realistic. If we can get this together and make sure we give it ample opportunity, this is the chance where we can push forward. Last thing for me, just in terms of our own personal stuff, we've been looking at the actual pod, the viability, as you know. We're loving what we're doing. We're going to try and keep going, but we will be looking at it again in February after the election to see what we can do. If you're getting something from it, please head over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. We do need support. Everybody who's come on board is making a difference, but we do need to look at it in terms of, you know, the time commitment, the cost, the opportunity cost, and everything else. So, look, thanks so much for your support. Over to a great podcast with a great doctor, and you will hear some of the stuff why it's so important that you get out and we vote. Thanks a lot. Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we are talking health. As always, I'm joined by my co-host and the man I'm so sick of the sight of.
And since we're talking about health, health of the podcast. Come on, patrons, sign on up there. Get in on the website. Become a patron. Look at all the work we're doing. Look at all the work we're doing, Tony.
No, much more importantly, we're delighted to be joined in the Tortoise Shack by GP and probably the most handsome man we've had this year already, Matthew O'Toole. Matthew, you, before you say hello, it's a diverse range of work you do. You work with Safety Net. We had Austin O'Carroll in, who was one of the key people who started this up.
Founder, yeah.
Yeah, and he was driving. And what you work with people who are homeless. You bring healthcare to where people who need it most don't get it.
Yeah.
You're also a GP 2 days a week as well. And as I said, he looks like he's off the page of GQ, but nonetheless.
Well, it's the brown shoes, Tony. They just screwed up altogether. Like, we say this all the time. If you're from the country, stop wearing brown shoes. Please stop wearing brown shoes.
Imagine, thanks for coming on to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
We know each other online, but we've seen so many things over the last while in terms of immigration, people talking about the rise in homelessness. And I know you have had first-hand experience of actually not just obviously the healthcare issue, but providing GP services which go beyond that. It's almost part of a holistic approach. Do you want to share with our listeners what that actually means?
Yeah, so I suppose to give you a bit of background. So what I do is I work for Safety Net, which is a charity that shouldn't exist in that it provides care to people that are homeless and can't get care anywhere else, and provides care to newly arrived asylum seekers, but also asylum seekers that can't get GPs. So I would work predominantly with asylum seekers at the moment, but also with the homeless population. With the asylum seekers specifically, what we do initially is when people come into Ireland and claim asylum, our role is to meet them and to offer them a health check or a health screening. So the idea there is that we would spend an hour with them and just talk to them about any health issues that they have, and then screen them for infectious diseases and then provide them with GP services. But the reality is, I mean, when they interact with us, generally it's the first time they've interacted, first of all, with Ireland Inc. And we're really conscious of that. Like, you know, it's the first time that they've actually had any chance to tell anyone their story. And the second time, in a lot of cases, the first time they've seen a doctor for a very long time. So it makes for a very interesting work. And then with the homeless services, I've been working with SafeNet now for 2 years, and that's a job that's getting busier and really more difficult as time goes by.
We've been fortunate to speak to a lot of terrific people over the years, and we spoke one of them who does amazing work in terms of speaking to newly arrived people who've had long journeys is Caoimhe Butterley. I don't know. And Caoimhe talks about the experiences, and that when you come face to face with these people, there has been a trauma.
Yeah.
Do you find that that is the case? And homelessness is a trauma. Like, yeah. I'm not just talking about the person who has fled a war zone, but these are traumas.
Yeah.
Do you find that that is constant something you come up against?
Always, every day. And I suppose, like, I was explaining this to students near RCSI a few weeks ago, people don't decide to pack up and leave their home for no reason. Most people, like, the decision is very simple. It's a life or death. So if they're going to stay in their home country, be that Zimbabwe or be that Georgia, the reason they're leaving is because if they stayed, they will likely be killed. So the decision to leave is an easy one. And they come in and they arrive, you know, in Ireland. And as I said, I mean, the experiences that they've experienced either in their home country or actually more often getting here is a lot more traumatic. So for example, I mean, I'll never forget my first week with SafetyNet. We went to, a village very far away from here in the southwest, and it was basically a newly arrived group of men that had crossed the Sahara. So they'd come from Eritrea, they'd come from Zimbabwe, and they crossed the Sahara. They had then been enslaved and tortured extensively in Libya, and then as they were repaying their debt through slave labor, paid smugglers to smuggle them across the Mediterranean. They then, you know, arrived in Greece. They were in Greece for several months. They eventually arrived in Ireland. And like that whole process was incredible. So we worked generally through translators. So I remember the first patient, my first time working for Satan, I sat down with them. And his story was just incredible. You know, I mean, he was leaving Eritrea. So a common pattern that I'm seeing at the moment is we have a lot of people who are coming to Ireland because of their sexual orientation. So Ireland is seen as a beacon around the world for gay rights, and that's purely because the Yes Equality campaign was really publicized. So we have a lot of people who are coming from all over the world to Ireland because of the Yes Equality campaign and this perception that your sexual orientation doesn't matter in Ireland. So this is a guy who was gay, and basically his family had thrown him out and his uncle was going to kill him. So he made the decision with no money, basically, to leave. So the first thing he did was manage to survive crossing the Sahara, which in itself is incredible. And basically arrived in Libya. As soon as he arrived in Libya, he was enslaved, which is what happens all the time. Libya, from my extensive, conversations with people that have gone through, it seems to be a completely broken state at the moment. And he experienced, you know, without going into detail, just incredibly difficult situations over the course of 2 years, like really, really difficult. Would have been tortured extensively. You know, eventually after 2 years of this just horrific torture, managed to get onto a boat where half the people on that boat died and drowned, then managed to make it to Greece. And then he comes to Ireland, and I never forget it. We had arrived, again, in this place in the southwest, I don't want to make it too identifiable, but I was arriving in with my bags, and there was all these African men just standing in the rain. And it was just an incredibly powerful moment. They were just literally standing there completely soaked through in the rain. And they were just so thankful for, number one, being free, but feeling safe. And, you know, they sit down and you ask them how you are, and invariably they tell you the story, which is just the most incredibly difficult story. And the problem is when they're crossing the Sahara, when they're in the boat in the Mediterranean, it's the adrenaline that's keeping them going, the hope of getting to Ireland. And then when they arrive here, they start to process what they've experienced, and that's really difficult. They develop horrific post-traumatic stress disorder. And one of the problems here is that we don't have the services in place to help them through that. But yeah, I mean, invariably, you know, I would say, I mean, we have statistics, so we look back. I mean, you know, nearly half of the women that we see have been raped. At the moment, I think it's about 15%, just looking back, I haven't got the figures to hand, but 15% of those that are coming here at the moment that we've screened are coming here because they've experienced discrimination based on their sexual orientation. Like a huge number of women have been trafficked. So the trauma, you know, it's invariable. It's unusual that someone hasn't experienced trauma.
I think it's good that the first thing that meets them is compassion. I think that's lacking. Once you've left that safety net, that's lacking. There is, it's kind of a bugbear of mine, is that both people coming from abroad and Irish people who are homeless, there is zero compassion within the system for them. From those who, from government down, there is zero compassion. They are a number. And there is nobody offering services to help. I mean, homelessness is a huge trauma, a massive trauma. And yet it's nobody's tackling this, or even the way they're processing people through it. You must declare yourself homeless. Not only must you declare yourself homeless, you have to tell people every single day, I'm homeless. You have to pick up a phone if you want somewhere to sleep and say, I'm homeless. And you have to keep repeating and repeating and repeating that you're homeless. And it's wearing people down. I mean, I know people who are suicidal from homelessness.
We lost someone this week in emergency accommodation, and I don't want to speak about specific cases, but I get quite choked up myself because I spoke to people who were new people in these situations, and it is a trauma. And what we're doing, you know, what you guys do about going to these people to give them GP care, because GP care is different to just, you know, I fell and I hurt my wrist. It's actually the family doctor was your GP.
Oh, it's your friend, Tony.
Exactly. So it's a bigger service, if that makes sense. How have you found the last couple of years? First of all, when did you start in Safety Net?
It was my first job when I qualified as a GP.
Yeah.
So literally the day I qualified as a GP, so 2 years.
2 years. And you see, because when we spoke to Austin, he spoke about the people who he loved that went into it, but also how they have found it to be something that they get so much out of.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah, well, I suppose I always wanted to work for MSF. That's why, one of the reasons I became a doctor. And that was one of the main things that kind of drove me to become a doctor. My sister has just completed her training now in Liverpool and will start with the MSF in the Congo soon.
She's a talented family.
Well, no, but like she's an incredible nurse and has worked with Safety Net, and I think she'll be a huge asset to the MSF when she does go. And I suppose at the time I had a lot of stuff kind of keeping me in Ireland. And basically it was just very random. This job had come up, and it is essentially like doing MSF but on Irish soil. You know, the stuff that we see tropical diseases, we see a lot of stuff, and it's incredibly interesting. I suppose, coming back to your point, what makes our job easier, I think, is that we interact with these people on a human level.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the stories that we're on a day-to-day basis, like, you couldn't but be compassionate and love these people. You know, I saw a man last week who, you know, first of all, he couldn't get around his head that he could see a doctor for free. He had come from the Lebanon, and he had actually donated his kidney in the Lebanon so that he could buy his daughter hearing aids.
Jesus.
So that was my first interaction with them that day. You know, it's incredible. But we're fortunate that we have that conversation with them. But when you're the person on the phone at the homeless services, you don't interact with them on a human level. It's a completely different experience. Yeah. If you did, I don't think you would, you know, you'd react that way.
It's very difficult. And I think there's a whole sector of care missing for people, where nobody is saying, what's the long-term effects on you? How can we help you other than put you in a house? You know, there are other things that you can do to help people as well.
Yeah, I think, I've said this a lot. Like, I mean, you know, I moved to Dublin in 2010 and we were financially bankrupt at the time. I generally think we're worse off now. I think we're morally bankrupt as a society. I think we're really, really morally bankrupt. And when I see, like, we've 10,000 people who are currently living in hotels, who are homeless, and the effect that has on those people and the kids is just incredible. Like, we had the lost generation with those that have emigrated. Now we have this new lost generation, and they're the people that are living in hotels, and that's going to have a detrimental impact on their lives. Like, I don't want to kind of be too graphic and kind of get into too much detail, but I mean, I met a patient 3 weeks ago and it had a profound impact on me. A woman who came into me who I knew was homeless, a single woman with her child, and I'd kind of been seeing her relatively frequently for recurrent chest infections. So she's you know, moving from homeless accommodation to homeless accommodation to homeless accommodation, and I've got to know her relatively well. And I kind of turned around to her and said, look, you look wrecked, you know, I'm really worried about you, like, you know. And she said to me, like, well, I don't sleep. And I said, why is it that you don't sleep? And she said, lovely 2.5-year-old child in front of her. And she said, well, there's no lock on our door. And she said, I'm staying in a homeless shelter at the moment with, you know, several other 100 people. And she said, I can't sleep at night because I'm worried that someone will come in and harm my child.
And Peter McVerry spoke about that this week. He said that if HIC were to inspect the temporary accommodation that people are put into, the vast majority will be closed down overnight.
Yeah, and I suppose I can see it from their perspective. So you can't have a lock on the door for security reasons in case someone is using drugs. But the reality is that this mother sits there for 8 hours and watches her child sleep, walks her child to school, and then goes to sleep on a park bench for six hours.
But you're probably the only person to ask her, you know, in a week, how are you? You're probably the only person to ask her in a week how she was.
But like, the lifestyle that she leads and the effect that that's not going to not only have on her, but her child, it's incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we spoke to Gabrielle Cullerin, the consultant pediatrician, who said she sees children who come into the hospital and they have no address to be released into. But what they find is that they find it hard to receive care almost because they're not used to certain things that they haven't had the supports and the structures around them, and they've missed it. We're going to use all that language of they've missed development goals. They've missed all of these key touchstones that we do. And we touched on earlier. I remember, not too long ago, myself and Martin, recorded a podcast in a hotel. And when we were leaving,
when we were leaving,
a gentleman came in his work overalls, holding his son's hand and carrying a buggy in a box, saying, "Come on, you're going to meet your little."
And the kids in school uniform.
Kid in school uniform. They're going to go meet his sister. The man had left his van outside. He was working, but he was homeless. And these are the people who were, you know, as you said, we're putting lives on hold. Mm. And I think it's really important that you said that. That's morally bankrupt in a country that, when we lost that decade, we had less people at work than we did at the top of the Celtic Tiger. We had less tax income receipts. We had less, how do I put this? I think it was 1,500 people homeless. And now in those 1,500 people homeless, we also included people that we've recategorized out of homelessness now. They don't even include. Like, so that poor man who coincidentally was Eritrean, who was lifted from his tent the other day. And, you know, we can talk about the Irish Times putting his nationality in a headline. But nonetheless, you know, he didn't exist on any register because when you're sleeping rough, you're not designated as homeless. Can I ask you, the supports from the state, you said at the outset, I work for Safety Net, a company that doesn't, charity. NGO that should not exist. Is it getting better or do you feel much hope?
No, like, it's getting worse. One of the things that SafeNet does, is we provide a kind of an urgent out of hours service in the evenings. I'm sure Austin would have talked about that. So, we basically work with the homeless services at night and we see people right across the city who homeless services have identified as being worrying about. I'd spend my time, Austin would as well, you know, climbing over walls, going into parks. And there's this whole other city in Dublin, which is the city of tents. Like, if you go, and again, I don't want to give out geographical areas, but there are parks in Dublin, which, you know, I climb over the wall with one of our nurses and there's like 50 tents in that park. And it's like a whole other city that just doesn't exist. And, you know, we would spend time going into these tents, seeing people that are incredibly unwell, really, really unwell, and providing medical care to them. But there's, as I said, there's an entire city at the moment. It's like the lost city that no one really cares about and no one knows exists.
Because they don't exist. What gets measured gets done. And if it's not measured, it doesn't exist. And that's, you know, that is an absolute scandalous outrage that we've reclassified people out of existence. And we've done that.
I think it was Austin who said that those who most need access to care are least likely to get the care that they need. So, you know, as long as you have a home, you can have access to a GP. You know, a GP being there will take it that the GP is there. Once you're homeless and you're moving, you've no access. You've zero access.
Well, we had up until very recent this perverse situation in Ireland that to apply for medical care, you had to have a postal address.
That's right.
Which meant when you were made homeless, the state basically meant, the state decreed that you couldn't get healthcare. That's changing a bit with this new postal address system that Impost has brought in. It's still not perfect and still, you know, most people can't apply for a medical care because they don't have an address. But I mean, completely, absolutely. And one thing that really annoys and frustrates me is what you hear from those in power is, well, he or she was offered accommodation several times. And that's the kind of get out of jail free clause.
That's a horrible, horrible
was
phrase.
Was known to.
Yeah. But, you know, people are homeless for a whole lot of complex reasons. And I've spoken to people in these tents, and I say to them, you know, why aren't you in a hostel? And the reality is that in some cases, life is better in a tent in Ireland than moving into a different hostel every single day. And the reality is, when you ring the free phone number, there might not be a bed for you. So I
sat with people on the Halfpenny Bridge, and I said, can we ring the number? He said, there's no beds. I said, do you mind if I ring the number with you? And I rang the number, there was no beds.
No. So, I mean, what this person said to me is, look, I mean, at least I know I have a tent.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and also, a tent is so much, I mean, it should be somewhat of security. It's not like sleeping in the open. But now I'm quite sure that everybody who has to sleep in a tent is now has that extra worry of, will my tent be grabbed and lifted and put in the back of a lorry?
Can I ask, and it's probably unfair of me, but if you had a magic wand, what would you like to do tomorrow?
For the homeless services, build houses. I mean, this happened in the 60s and 70s. It doesn't take a rocket scientist.
It happened in the 20s and the 30s when they said clear the tenements and onwards, you know?
Yeah, but I mean, they've in Finland, if you look at what they did in Finland, they basically eradicated homelessness. What did they do? They built houses.
That's right.
I mean, Fine Gael, and I don't want to, you know, politicize this, but their thing is, we leave it to the markets, and the markets will eventually solve this. The markets have clearly proven that they have not been able to solve this. And we just need to build houses, and that's what we need to do.
And with healthcare too, market driven healthcare is not necessarily the best form of healthcare. It's just not.
No, I mean, the reality is, in terms of healthcare in Ireland, and I'm sure that everyone you've had on has told you that it's getting worse. And Gabrielle, I mean, you know, would be the first person to agree with that. I mean, the reality is that things have gotten much, much worse. So when I was in college, Mary Harney decreed that there was an emergency in healthcare when there was 380 people on trolleys. Mm-hmm. We've doubled that now. And again, we're supposed to be this, you know, booming society that's incredibly wealthy.
I think what you said about it being morally bankrupt, I think there's a huge grain of truth in that. And we see it's spread outside of politics. We now see it in we have murder, mayhem and mutilation going on. And that is moral corruption. People are morally corrupted. But I think that also comes from on high. I think that's the dog eat dog, the them and us. Instead of us looking at us as a society, it's separate societies. And as you said, there's a city nobody knows about in Dublin. It's a separate society, and it's separated. We also have that in healthcare, and we also have it with refugees and asylum seekers.
You've done work in terms of, say, things like Sláinte Care. Sláinte Care was referred to within the last 2 weeks by a former aide of the Minister for Finance on Twitter as a pretend idea. Not many people picked up on it, but it really drove me mad. What do you think, is there a real ambition behind that plan, or is that just simply something that that has been rolled out every now and then to say, listen, don't worry, the city on the hill will be here someday?
Well, we're 5 years into a 10-year plan now. I think that speaks volumes.
Yeah. It does.
What I would say about Sláinte Care, I think Sláinte Care is highly aspirational. I think in a utopian society, I think it's a great idea. But the problem with Sláinte Care is you need to have a health service that's on a really healthy foundation before you go towards that. So I'm always trying to explain this to people, that the biggest problem in healthcare is capacity and accessibility. And at the moment, we have a huge issue when it comes to capacity within the health service. And as I said, once the capacity reduces, accessibility reduces. So if you look at really simple statistics in Ireland, we come pretty high up on the top when it comes to the amount that we spend per capita or per capita in terms of the OECD countries. Ooh. We're actually number 30 out of 30 in terms of accessibility. So we actually can't get any worse. And the problem with Sláinte Care at the moment is we don't have enough doctors to deliver it, and we don't have enough consultants, and we don't have the structures in place to do it. So, I mean, Sláinte Care, what we were doing is moving towards the NHS model of care. And that's not perfect. It's far from perfect. And from a GP perspective, it means that people will wait 3 weeks to see a GP. And that is hugely problematic. At the moment, general practice is struggling to cope. And the reality is that we don't have the health service on a stable footing to be able to move towards Sláinte Care. The reality is, and my big fear with Sláinte Care is, that it will lead to an even bigger divide between public and private service. So, when we move towards a fully staunchy care model, my fear, and this is kind of what we're seeing at the moment, is that the private sector in healthcare in Ireland is booming.
Yes.
And if we do move towards a situation whereby the capacity within the health service is shrunk to nothing, then the private health service will boom.
So it's such a Chomsky thing, isn't it? I know it's an old trope, but it's, defund, and then run it into the ground and make the, give the actual alternative is this thing over here. And what we're seeing now, and doctor after doctor, consultant after consultant tells us this, is that the private hospitals can cherry pick the procedures they want to take, and then a minister can then run down the actual public service saying, but the private hospitals are delivering. You're going, of course they're delivering. You're letting them take the easiest options and the most profitable, the most lucrative, and they're taking them. And and the public, we don't have time to look up from our cornflakes or whatever we're eating, and we just don't get it sometimes. But it must be insanely frustrating when you're on the front line like you are.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, I'd love to live in a society where the service you got in the private sector was as good as what you got in the public sector. The reality is, if you've had a stroke or heart attack or a major illness, then yes, the care, or cancer, the care you get in the public sector is incredible. But outside of that, the care is very poor. I mean, I work, as I said, with the homeless services, and I work in GP practice, and I work in Ranelagh. I'm very happy to say that, where the majority of our population do have access to private healthcare. And I'm a different GP. So if a member of the homeless, for example, if a homeless patient comes into me in the morning, and he has, just to use a very simple example, arthritis of his knee. And again, when it comes to the unfortunately, those that are homeless, they develop diseases and chronic diseases much, much earlier. I have auscultated the chest of a 22-year-old man who is homeless, and it sounds like a 60-year-old. And that's because they're living essentially on the streets. Like, we're regressing in some ways because they're spending the huge amount of time outside, and they're developing diseases that they should not be developing in their 20s. But again, going back to that, simple thing like arthritis of the knee, that person will wait 2 years to get an MRI if he's a public patient.
That's right.
And then once he gets the MRI, he'll wait another 2 years to have that operation. Whereas if a private patient comes into me in Ranelagh, I can have the MRI done in a day and the knee replaced in a week.
And she can drive to the sports clinic at Santry and they'll do...
But that's wrong.
Oh, absolutely.
It's totally wrong.
It is. I have a friend who's, she won't mind me saying it, she's early 40s, and her hip is gone, and she's looking at a 2 year wait. And that's incredible. This is a person who was working, has had to stop working, really wants to get back to work. And there's this huge, big chunk of time she's been told no, just simply because you don't have private health insurance. You're now out of the jobs market. You're now very dependent on social welfare. And it's an awful way. The quickest, easiest solution is fix her hip and put her back out to work.
Yeah, I mean, what frustrates me, and obviously I'm biased because I'm a GP, but we spend 3% of the entire health budget on general practice. 97% of it is spent in the hospital sector. Obviously, some things need to get done in the hospital sector, but everything you do in the hospital costs exponentially more than what you do in the GP sector. So again, my thing with this is, in Ireland, we always feel like we need to reinvent the wheel. We just need to look at the countries where things are going well. So if you look at Scotland, for example, is a really similar population dynamic to us in terms of the size of the country, the way the country's, there's a huge rural population, and they have twice the number of hospital beds, twice the number of consultants, and twice the number of GPs. But importantly, they spend exponentially more amount on general practice. So again, a really simple example. So as a GP, if I was to come in, let's say Tony comes in with an ingrown toenail, I can remove that toenail for, all things considered, about 60, 70 quid.
Pick on my toes.
Just an example, right? Because I can do that on my own without a nurse, without an anaesthetist in my GP practice, without a hospital. But at the moment in Ireland, GPs aren't resourced to do that. So if Tony was coming to me as a GMS patient, I as a GP would get paid €55 to look after you for the entire year. So that's 55 quid to provide you with 24/7 care 365 days a year. So basically, your Netflix subscription, is a two days more expensive than 24/7 care, 365 days a year. So what ends up happening is I end up having to refer you, because in order to even get the kit to remove your toenail, it costs me about 40 quid. So I'll end up making a loss on it. So referring them into hospital, then you get it done with an anaesthetist in the hospital. It's done by a surgeon. It'll cost about 1,500 quid. So what they've done in all other developed countries is they've moved as much of this as they can into GP. They've enabled GPs to do stuff like book MRIs, book CTs, really simple things. So again, in the public service, which really frustrates me, I'm not allowed to book CTs or MRIs. So again, if I need to book an MRI of your knee, I have to refer you on to one of my consultant colleagues for an MRI. And then he'll see you in 2 years and say, Matt was right. In fact, it's got much worse. I will book that MRI now. So that's actually doubling the amount of times that patient has to be seen by a consultant. So instead of me booking the MRI and then sending him on to the orthopedic surgeon, he has to see the orthopedic surgeon twice, once to book the MRI and then once to read the MRI. So the whole system is completely broken. And the problem is, and I've spoken to ministers of health about this because it makes no sense and the solution is so obvious. When Simon Harris wakes up on tomorrow morning, the first thing that'll come up on his phone is the number of people who are on a trolley that day. And all that matters to him is getting that number down.
Yes.
So all he does, whether it's the winter plan or the increase in budget, it's the National Treatment Purchase Fund, which is this perverse idea that you basically pay private healthcare to on a very, very short-term basis sort the problem. What we need to be doing is coming up with a plan where we have a 5 or 10 year plan, which isn't actually staunch care, where we actually incrementally increase funding into general practice to allow GPs to do that. And again, it's not rocket science. For the last 20 years, we've done the exact same thing, which is pour more money into the hospitals. And if anything, we're actually in a worse situation today than we were before.
It's more acute, yeah.
Like, we're spending 20 billion euros a year on healthcare now.
Can I ask you, because you're a GP in Ireland, and a lot of people who are coming through the colleges now are just looking at Ireland and say, there's no bloody way.
Mm.
Why do you stay here?
Why do I stay here? The reason I actually became a GP initially, other than the MSF, was to be a GP at home. So I had very little interaction with the health service when I was younger. The only interaction I had was with my GP, who was an incredible doctor. And when I went to college, my reason for being a GP was I wanted to actually replace him. Really simple, simple idea. And then when I became a doctor and I, you know, trained to be a GP, I looked at the life that he had and I couldn't believe that a man in his 60s was doing what he's doing. So he's a single-handed GP in rural Ireland. He was on call, you know, he'd work a minimum 100 hours a week. So there wasn't any Dub Doc or North Doc like you have in Dublin. So he was on call all the time. So I distinctly remember my parents on a Sunday evening, if there was a problem, they just ring the GP or a Friday afternoon and he was always there. You know, I can never remember a situation where we rang him and he wasn't there. That's great for you as a patient. But as a doctor, that takes a huge toll on you. And the reality is that my generation of doctors, they're not willing to sacrifice absolutely everything to be a doctor. The second issue is that the reality of being a GP in Ireland is incredibly frustrating. So as I said, if you're a GP in the public service, you literally are, you've spent 10 years in college. You're one of the most skilled doctors. So as I said, as a GP, you know, I see 30, 40 patients a day. I deal with psychiatry, pediatrics, obstetrics, minor surgery, absolutely everything. But I'm not enabled by the states to work to my full potential. So I can't get access to any scans. I can't get an MRI, I can't get a CT. GPs could do so much more, but their hands are completely tied by the state. So these really highly trained doctors that have spent 10 years to become GPs, when they work in the Irish system, they're so incredibly frustrated, they move. And again, what the politicians always say is that they're moving for better money. They're not. Actually, if you look at where GPs go, a lot of them go to the NHS, to the UK, where they're actually paid less.
Yeah.
And the reason is, as a GP in the NHS, for example, like if I have a patient who I think might have MS or a patient I feel needs a knee replacement, I need to be able to get my specialist colleagues to help me with that. Mm. In Ireland, that doesn't really exist. Yeah. I mean, the waiting list to see a urologist in Waterford at the moment is 8 years. Like, as a GP, you're going to see that patient who you know needs to have specialist care and probably an operation for the next 8 years as he deteriorates and gets worse and gets worse and gets worse. So you've these incredibly trained doctors, and like the GPs we're churning out now are in huge demand worldwide because they're really good. But they're just not able to work to their full potential, and the system tends to break them and they tend to leave. So it's not about money.
And we have said, like, you know, and it's a real proper vicious circle, because when you say about the care in the hospitals, then where people need to be treated, care in the community, and when you're under-resourced the community, and then they turn around and they use that awful phrase that Martin always throws out, bed blockers. You know, well, they have nowhere to go because we don't have any, we're not resourcing this. And GP, the actual physical GP, the community GP, they're a dying breed.
Yeah.
They're like, I mean, it's not, I'm not exaggerating. You have it in your bloody Twitter bio, you know, fighting for the future of general practice.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I was the president of the AGP a year ago and I spent a year traveling the country. And like, it's just incredible the number of GPs that should have retired and that aren't retiring because they have this sense of duty to their community. But like the figures are stark. Like, we have 700 GPs that are due to retire in the next 3 to 4 years. I think the figure is much higher because a lot of them are holding back. And a huge number of our graduates are leaving. Like, it's really simple mathematics. Like, we do not have the number that we need to look after. We've like 26 communities at the moment where people can't get GPs. Ashburn, for example, at the moment, they have two practices, they're full. And people, they're building housing estates left, right and centre in Ashburn. None of those people will be able to get a GP. So what they do is they drive to Dublin.
You can get a pizza.
Get a pizza.
But you can't get a GP.
Yeah. And I mean, Ashburn is lucky.
That's the truth.
Ashburn is lucky because you're beside Dublin. But I mean, if you're in Macroom, like I met a family the last day, and when their child is sick, they throw the child into the back seat, and it's a 1.5 hour round trip every time the child is sick. Like, as a society, we really need to ask ourselves, why is this happening?
But GP care has been pretty much wiped out in the US. I mean, that's what happened in the US when they went down this route. GP care got wiped out. And now your access is always through a specialist. It's always through a specialist, and it costs a fortune, an absolute fortune. That's why the American system is so fucked. There is nobody to filter people where they need to go. And that's why it's screwed. It's utterly screwed. And it's a basket case. And if you don't have 100K a year, you're dependent on charity. We're kind of there now.
We're very quickly going there.
You know, at this stage, your health is your wealth. The poorer you are, the worse your outcomes, and your access, and it is access, your access to get in is really, really, really difficult. It's really difficult, particularly if you've complications. It's very difficult to see the specialist you need to see. So your life, you are warehoused as much as you would be as if you were put in a homeless hub. You are warehoused on a list simply because your income doesn't meet the standard the government has set to allow you to have healthcare. And that's the bottom line. It's destroying it.
Yeah. And I mean, the other thing is this idea of extending free care to people under the age of 13. As a GP, I mean, universal healthcare is a great idea. The problem is that, again, in Ireland, we're the only society in the world that's decided to give people access to healthcare based on age, not on need. Kids between the age of 4 and 13 are probably the healthiest people in society.
Yeah, exactly.
And I see a lot of people, I talk to a lot of people on Twitter, and a lot of patients that I have that have cancer and that they have their medical care taken off them. But it's crazy. Like, we need to be providing, I mean, when we're introducing medical care, the idea of universal care, you need to give it to people that can't afford it and people that need it.
Well, if you'd extended the bans on the medical card,
that's the safest and fairest way to do it.
That was the fairest way to do it. Giving it to children, it is commendable, of course. So we'd love to have universal health care, but giving health care to the healthiest group of people, free healthcare to the healthiest group of people, is counterproductive, and it's causing more and more problems in GPs.
It is, but I mean, if you're going to do it right, and the way that every other society across the world did it was they gave healthcare, they slowly, increased
the
income thresholds.
Yeah,
exactly. And that's the fairest way to do it. I mean, the reality is, like, Michael O'Leary's kids have free healthcare. It doesn't make any sense. Whereas people who are just above the income threshold struggle. So it makes no sense, but this was, it's an election ploy. It didn't actually work the last time, and I'm not sure it's going to work now.
I genuinely don't think the electioneering that's been going on has been very effective recently.
No, we were just saying that nobody has come out in front. There is no, it's kind of like the news cycle is actually more important than the political cycle, because what's happening in real life, and this is again all consequences of being of living in a morally bankrupt society, that you have drugs, you have murders, you have mutilations, you have people getting hurt who are homeless. That's all the news cycle. Politics is second place.
My kind of big fear at the moment looking at politics is that it's become very like the politics in the States and the UK, whereas people just lie all the time. It's genuinely really concerning. Like, I mean, I was listening to the radio and I've decided I'm going to call people out on it going forward. I had a TD who last week said, there are GPs moving to Drogheda every week. And that's what he said. And I mean, I was like, well, that's great. That's where they must all be hiding. We had another minister say over the week that we have 1,000 new extra GPs in the last 5 years in Ireland. And the figure is actually 90. And that figure is totally inaccurate, because it's extra GMS lists.
Unbelievable
But that's a lie.
Twice.
That's
a complete lie. But twice.
And this other thing that we have a new GP contract which keeps being thrown out. It's not true. Our GP contract is 50 years old. What
it's
we have
the GMS
is,
contract.
Yeah, what we've had is an agreement basically that they'll pay GPs to do more work. But I've been really surprised in that. I suppose I'm a bit longer in the tooth now. Like, I know the answer to these questions, and these are blatant lies. Like, stand up and say.
Only today I had one. Where a minister said that they'd built 10,000 social homes.
11,000 houses in total. In total.
For the, and
it was, under Rebuilding Ireland.
Rebuilding Ireland have to build 25,000 a year, which was their initial plan. And it was an average of 25,000 houses a year up to the completion of the plan. And they haven't achieved it once, not once. And he stood and he said, well, this is, and he said, well, no, that never happened. And I had the original picture. And I sent it to the journalist. I said, there's the original 2016 Rebuilding Ireland launch where it says an average of 25,000. Yeah. Well, they changed that line recently to say 120,000 homes over the course of the over the course of the plan. You're going, no, you see, you can't do that, folks. You can, and that is, and it's the same with healthcare where they turned around and said, no one will be waiting more than 12 months. Did we say 12 months? We meant 18.
Yeah.
No one will be, and they changed those
the
things.
Posts.
And then they'll turn around and the same minister will stand up and say, we've made great progress this year. We've reduced that waiting time by X percentage because they've actually moved the goalposts. And I find that very frustrating, and it takes gobshites like us who are just total nerds about this stuff that went to the point of saving the stuff from Rebuilding Ireland a few years ago and then be able to pull it out and say, actually, no, I definitely have these facts here and I can pull them up. But it's not; it doesn't gain traction with the public because, sadly...
But I think you're right. And you made the decision now. If you hear a lie, you're going to call out a lie. And not bigging us up, but we were on Blind Boy, bigging us up. And it's my thing. It's my thing. If I hear a lie now, I'm not going to go, you misspoke, you're mistaken, or some other euphemism for what they're actually doing is lying through the fucking teeth. And no, I'm not going to say it's okay in America, it's okay with Johnson, it's okay here. No, it's not. If you lie, every door you turn up, the person should go, you're a fucking liar, fuck off.
I think it's interesting, like, if you look at, and again, not to get into the politics of it, but like the Fine Gael slogan at the moment is the future to look forward to. But that infers that we should just forget about the past and forget about the current situation. Like, the future.
Judge us on our promises, not our practices.
I mean, if we continue on the path that we're on at the moment, the future is not a bright place. Like, we need to change.
And I will add that Fianna Fáil's an Ireland for All, that's not in practice either. As you said, there is a secret city within Dublin. There are secret communities who are not Ireland for All, or are nowhere close to Ireland for All.
Last thing. If we were to look at, we have to aspire to the NHS, which is also under pressure now. GPs, what do we need in just GP community care? What would be the model that we should look at?
The countries that GPs are going towards predominantly at the moment are Canada and Australia. And so again, you look at what they're doing in Canada and Australia and you try to replicate that here. They don't spend that much more money per head of population than we do. They've twice the number of GPs, for example, in Canada and Australia than we do here. But what they do is very simple. They just enable the GP to do the maximum amount of work that he can. So as I said, we have this highly trained doctor in the community and they've identified this in Canada and Australia and they've enabled that GP to do as much as he can in the community. So that GP has all the backup, all the diagnostics, whatever he needs to do his job, he has it. And they would look at a referral into the hospital as a failure. So every time someone is sent to the emergency department, that the system has failed. And the Canterbury model in New Zealand, which is the model that they're trying to aspire towards in Sláinte Care, has done huge things for the health service in New Zealand. We just need to move away from this hospital-centric model of care where all the roads really lead to the emergency department or lead to the hospital, and move away from that and try to do as much as we can within the community. And that involves enabling GPs to do what we're doing. And again, like over the last 20 years, what we've done is just pour more and more money into the hospital system without really trying to address it and move that, you know, budget away from it. Like, as I said, it's 3% of the entire health budget spent on GPs, and GPs see over 90% of patients a year. It just doesn't make sense. And again, we don't need to set up another committee. We just need to look at who's doing this well. Canada, Australia, they're doing it really well. We just need to replicate the model there. But I wouldn't be too hopeful at the moment for the way things are going. I just don't see anyone coming out with a radical solution to improve things.
Well, thank you for coming in and have a chat. I have to say, and I know Tony's going to echo this, I'm glad you're the person meeting people coming to our shores for the first time. I'm glad you were. I'm glad that you're the friendly face they meet. I'm glad that you care. I'm glad that you're compassionate. That shows that something's working. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for listening, folks. Again, live show, 26th of January. We are going to be talking this, no doubt. We will have a packed out audience, fingers crossed.
But get your
tickets.
Yeah, tickets quick.
And by the way, you know, we're looking to get Martin a new hat, so.
I have no hat at the moment.
Can I just say, well, if you're still there, if you're still bothered listening, this man has done back to back to back to podcast today, and he has been in absolute agony. I don't give you much credit, but fair play to you, mate. Talk to you all soon. Take care.
Thanks for having me.